Esther chapter 5 this morning. We want to look at Esther chapter 5. And I've given the title of this chapter, Pride Goes Before a Fall. Now, if you remember at the end of chapter 4, Esther and Mordecai were woken up by God from their complacency and their compromise. And he didn't just waken them up. He woke up all the Jews in exile in Persia. Maybe as many as 15 million of them were in the Persian Empire, away from the city of Jerusalem. And we know that they were making a lot of money because Haman promised a huge sum of money if he was allowed to destroy the Jews. Somewhere in the region of a few hundred billion US dollars worth of gold and silver is what he promised. It was almost three quarters of the budget in 1 year of the whole Persian Empire. That's a lot of money. So these Jews were doing very well who didn't go back to Jerusalem. They were enjoying the good life. They were rich. They had beautiful homes. They were bringing up families. They were enjoying life as Persians with a Greek Jewish identity. God starts to shake them up here, drive them to their knees, and starts to show them that their money can't buy them freedom and happiness and peace and joy. And Esther, she has declared at the end of chapter 4 that she's willing to go into the king's presence, risk her life, risk her position for her people. And she ends chapter 4 by saying, if I perish, I perish. If God's will is for me to die, I'll let him make that decision. Now, Esther is a girl that we've criticized a lot over the first four chapters, and rightly so. But now really is her finest hour in this whole story, because she's willing to risk everything to save people she doesn't even know from every corner of the Persian Empire. Now, she has promised to go into the king, and a lot of people talk the talk, but when it comes to what? Walk the walk. They back out. And Esther's waited 3 days, because you'll see in verse 1 of chapter 5, it's the third day, 48 hours at least, maybe even 72 hours, between when she made her statement, I'll go into the king, and when she eventually comes into the king's presence. So there's at least 48 hours for her to change her mind. And I'm sure in that period of time, those 2 or 3 days, the devil was speaking all kinds of temptations into her heart and into her mind, and saying to her, you shouldn't throw your life away. You're influential. I mean, these people that are going to die, they're not your problem, Esther. They did nothing for you when you were an orphan. They didn't take care of you. Esther, you're safe in the palace. Haman doesn't even know you're a Jew. He can't touch you. Just keep quiet. And if God wants to save the Jews, he can save them. He doesn't need your help. And I'm sure all of these thoughts were in Esther's mind over that 48-hour to 72-hour period. And she knows this, that to approach this king Ahasuerus when she hasn't been invited is fraught with many difficulties and dangers. She knows, for example, that in going into the king's palace to seek an audience when she hasn't been invited was to break the law of the Persians. In fact, the penalty for breaking this law is not a slap on the wrist. The penalty is death, a cruel, painful death. She also knows that when she comes before the king, she has to admit that she has deceived him for the last 5 years in hiding her Jewish ancestry. Well, that's not going to be an easy thing to tell a man like Ahasuerus. She has to persuade Ahasuerus also, this proud man, this dictator. She has to effectively persuade him to change his mind. That's not going to be easy. He's not a guy that likes to be told what to do. He's not a person that likes to be told you're wrong, especially by a woman. Vashti, his previous wife, when she tried to disobey him, he dealt with her ruthlessly. Esther knows that in coming into the presence of the king, she not only has to face all of those problems and all of those obstacles, but she has to face down a cunning, powerful adversary called Haman. A man of great influence. A man who is a friend of the king, the closest friend of the king. A man of power. A man who's good with words. And Esther knows that in coming into the presence of the king, ultimately, she has to persuade the king to lose face in public. Remember, the king has made this law, sealed this law, that all the Jews are to be killed. And for him to change his mind on that, and for her to persuade him to change his mind, means that inevitably there's going to be a humiliation. Inevitably, he's going to lose some face before the Persian people. So all of these reasons would have made Esther very, very nervous. But we discover that she spent 3 days without food or drink, fasting, and I believe also praying for help. First time ever she seeks God in this story. First time ever she really realizes she needs God. And she spends these hours with her maidens and Mordecai and the others crying unto God for God's intervention, for God's wisdom. And I believe one of the things she would have asked God was that prayer from James chapter 1. If any man lacks wisdom, let him what? Ask of God, who giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, or condemns us not, or complains against us for asking. And then at the end of that verse it says, and it shall be given him. God says, you shall get it. So I believe Esther really asked God, Lord, give me wisdom. Teach me what to say. Teach me how to dress. Teach me the right demeanor. And you know, as you read this story, you have to admire the wisdom of Esther, how she approaches this guy Ahasuerus. On the third day, she waits. Third day waiting for God to guide her. And she comes in before the king, and we're told she put on her royal apparel. She dressed up as the queen in showing her dignity, but also showing her respect for this man, Ahasuerus. She's his queen. Of course, there's a little lesson there for all of us. When you come before the presence of God in corporate worship, you should dress up appropriately. You shouldn't dress as if you're going to the beach or going to the cinema. You're coming here to worship the Lord, the King of Kings. And Esther, she's coming into the presence of an earthly king, and she dresses appropriately. But not only does she dress appropriately, we're told that she came to the inner court, and she doesn't rush into the presence of the king. We're told in verse 2, she was standing in the king. She kept her distance. She showed modesty. She showed meekness, discretion. And she's standing there waiting for the king to call her in. Well, she's very wise. She's not brash. She's not bold. She's certainly no feminist, is she? She's not marching in demanding her way. She's very wise and tactful how she handles this very difficult man, Ahasuerus. Now, it's a very tense moment for her. as she stands at the back of the royal court. Because if Ahasuerus doesn't reach out the golden scepter to her, then his bodyguards will take the sword to Esther. So she's literally hanging between life and death at this point. And there's no guarantee that Ahasuerus will extend the scepter. If he's in a bad mood, she could lose her life. If he's fed up with her, this is a perfect chance for him to get another girlfriend. Get rid of her. I mean, he's already done it with Vashti. He's not Mr. Husband, reliable husband, is he? This guy. He's got all these other girlfriends and concubines that he enjoys himself with. So he's quite happy to get rid of her if it suits him. And the tension is in the story. And just at the last moment, the king reaches out the golden scepter. At this breach of protocol in the Persian Empire. Remember, the last queen lost her position for breaching the protocol. And he reaches out the golden scepter and calls her to him, and she draws near, the Bible says. And when she comes near to him, she doesn't speak. She lets him speak. See how wise she is? See how careful she is? And when he speaks, he says, "What wilt thou," verse 3, "Queen Esther?" He says, "What do you want?" He knows that there's something on her mind. He's smart enough, this guy Ahasuerus, to know that her taking this risk was for a reason, a very, very important reason. He says, "What is thy request?" Well, he knows she wants something, and it must be so important that she's willing to risk her life for it. And he makes this offer. "It shall be even given thee to the half of the kingdom." Now, this is a typical exaggeration in speech. I don't believe Ahasuerus is going to give her half the kingdom. She said, "Okay, I'll take half of all your money and half of the position of this kingdom. I'll be joint monarch with you." But it's just typical of these type of individuals. They're just showing off. "What do you want? I'll give you up to half the kingdom." Now, this is a very perfect opportunity, many would say, for Esther to ask this king to save the Jewish people. Many of us would jump in at such a moment, wouldn't we? Say, okay, now you've made your offer. Here's what I want. I want you to get rid of Haman, and I want you to save the Jewish people, my people. But Esther doesn't. What does she say? Verse 4, "If it seem good unto the king." Again, she's respectful. She's handling this proud ego very well. And she says, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." Now, the key word here is prepared. Esther already had come that day with a plan. And the plan was to get the king and Haman alone with her, to talk to him about the Jewish people. Now, why did she procrastinate? Why did she delay? Why did she put it off and say, "Well, let's have a banquet first"? And I think there's a number of answers if you think carefully, and it will reveal the wisdom of Esther. Number one, and I think this is the big, big one. If Esther had come out straight away and said, "I want you to kill Haman and save the Jewish people," I think that would have been very difficult for Ahasuerus to accept in front of all his people in the royal palace. That would have been a huge loss of face, wouldn't it? Everybody would have realized he's made a mistake. And even if he was willing to correct it, it would have been hard for him to correct it with so many people watching. I also think that her revealing she was a Jew in front of all those people would have been very difficult for Ahasuerus to accept also. Because then people said, oh, you didn't even know you're married to her? What kind of a king are you? She fooled you for 5 years. What type of a man are you? I think also she was clever in that she had discerned that Ahasuerus likes the food, doesn't he? We've seen that already. He likes the banquets. And the best way to a man's heart is through his what? Now, you know the saying. Listen, ladies, very carefully. Through his stomach. And Ahasuerus must have a big stomach after all the feasts he goes through. And she's wise. She knows. Better to have him not sitting on the royal throne in formality in front of all these people as the king. But get him more relaxed. Get him to let, as we would say, let his hair down. And then he'd be more open in a private situation to helping her with her request. I think also there's less potential for distractions in such a private gathering as in a public gathering. Because if you can imagine, if Esther stands up and starts to give this speech, what happens if something comes in to distract Ahasuerus or someone? So Esther's very wise. I believe God gave her the wisdom to ask for this delay, for this private feast. Because you'll discover later on in the story, the delay that Esther asked for, God uses to provide a way to save the life of Mordecai. Now, the king, verse 5, he doesn't ask Haman, what's your diary like today? Are you free this evening? He just says, no, you tell Haman he's coming. And Haman jumps to the request. And then in verse 6, the banquet is in full flow. In fact, we're told it's a banquet of wine. You can imagine this king and Haman, the booze is flowing. And the king says to Esther at the banquet, what is thy petition? Ahasuerus is not stupid. He knows she didn't risk her life for a dinner date. And he says to her, and it shall be granted thee. What is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom, it shall be performed. Now, again, in verse 7 and 8, it's very interesting. Esther doesn't jump in and say, okay, this is what I want. She delays again. And she says to the king, he says, let you and Haman come back tomorrow for another banquet. And she discerns that this is not the right time to speak. I don't know how she knows, but she knows. Maybe God, as I said, had revealed this to her before she went. Now, there's a risk in postponing what she wants to say for another day. And here's the risk. The risk is that Ahasuerus could get fed up. He's a big spoiled child, Ahasuerus. That's basically who he is. And if you keep bringing him back for the same thing, he'd probably get fed up in a short time. That's the risk. The risk is he also might change his mind. He might not make the offer again. I'm willing to help you, Esther, whatever you want. Well, here's another risk. The longer she delays bringing this request, Haman may discover her real reason. Haman's a very cunning guy. He's a very clever guy. He's a person who knows how to find out secrets. Because a fox can always catch a fox, isn't that right? Very easily. He's a fox, this guy, Haman. He's a liar. And he knows how to disguise his emotions. So there's a risk in delaying another day that Haman might actually work out what the real reason is. And he might turn against her. And he might try to intervene to destroy her as she waits. But of course, in delaying, Haman's pride is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Because the Persians didn't allow any other man to be in the presence of the queen but the king. And this is a very special privilege given to Haman. A very unique privilege. And he's not just given it on one day, he's asked to come back the next day. Wow. And Haman is, well, I'm a foreigner and I'm treated like the king's son. Maybe Haman thought that he was going to be the next king. I'm sure he was plotting. If I get the chance, I'll stick the knife into Ahasuerus and take the throne. And we're told, verse 9, then went Haman forth that day joyful and with a glad heart. Oh, he's so thrilled. I'm somebody. The king loves me. The queen loves me. I'm rich. I'm powerful. And maybe if even things work out, I might even get the throne. Somewhere down the line. And Haman is just full of himself, full of pride. But what's his happiness tied to? His happiness is tied to the favor of men. His happiness is simply tied and anchored to material possessions, position, and power. And you know, there's a lot of people like that today. If you ask them, are they happy? Say, I'm happy. Why are you happy? Well, I've got A and B and C, and things are going my way in work. My investments are on the rise. My bank account grows day by day, week by week. People like me. I have a lot of friends. My family are doing well. And their happiness is tied to external circumstances. And they say, I'm happy inside. I'm feeling cool, feeling relaxed, even joyful. But here's the problem. If you tie your happiness to external circumstances, like Haman did, those external circumstances can change in just a moment of time, can't they? And you're going to see how quickly Haman's mood will change. He's an emotional roller coaster, you know, up and down. Because the very same verse, verse 9, it says, when he went forth that day, he began joyful, with a glad heart. But then it says, but, oh, here comes the roller coaster. But when Haman saw Mordecai, just one person, fly in the ointment, in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation. Ah, the mood changed. The happiness didn't last, did it? It didn't even last 24 hours. In fact, it didn't even last an hour. And he's furious. He's mad. And of course, there's a profound illustration here of the foolishness of building your life on the opinion of other people. Building your life on material things. They never produce lasting happiness. Yes, they produce some happiness. Don't misunderstand me. Haman was happy for a few minutes, wasn't he? He was happy for a few minutes. But did it last? No. If you turn with me to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. We have a story here of a man who understood this very carefully, growing up in a different circumstance. And his name is called Moses. If you turn to verse 24 of Hebrews chapter 11,
It says, by faith Moses, when he was come to years, that expression means when he became grown up, when he became an adult, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, the Egyptians at this time were the richest nation on the earth. They were the most powerful nation on the earth. They were the most advanced nation on the earth. And even today, we admire their brilliance. The pyramids, for example. We don't even know how they built them. They're an engineering marvel. So Moses grew up in the royal palace, educated by the best scholars and engineers, in all the wisdom, the book of Acts tells us, of the Egyptians. He understood. He had a great mind, and he had the greatest education money could buy. And Pharaoh put his hand on Moses, and he said, you're my heir. You're my son. And Moses grew up with the knowledge that he could be the next Pharaoh of the greatest empire in the world. Now, that's some offer. That's not insignificant. All the power, all the prestige, all the wealth. In the book of Acts, we're told Moses was mighty in word and in deed. He was a very charismatic guy. In fact, Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us he became a mighty leader in the battles. He was a mighty general. So here's a brilliant man, a talented man, a very gifted man, with the whole world at his feet. And when he comes to maturity, the Bible says he refused to become the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He says, I don't want it. Now, why did he make that choice? Look at the next verse, verse 25. Choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Are there pleasures in sin? Is there happiness in sin? Absolutely. If there wasn't, nobody would ever be attracted. Isn't that right? I often hear these stupid Christians go around saying to people, oh, there's no pleasure in sin. Rubbish. Of course there's pleasure in sin. That's why people run to it. But Moses knew there was pleasure in sin, but he knew something else about it. Notice the last three words in that verse. For a season. Doesn't last. Happiness is temporal, temporary. The guy that gets himself full of the drink, the next day he wakes up, the pain is still there, isn't it? The loneliness is still there. The guy that indulges in the immorality, the next day, the emptiness is still there. This pleasure, yes, but it doesn't last. It doesn't last. And Moses understood this. And unlike Haman, he said, no. I don't want to go that way. That's the way to destruction. That's the way to ultimate loss. There's no satisfaction there. And what did Moses choose? Verse 26, Hebrews chapter 11. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. For he had respect. In other words, he understood, he discerned unto the recompense that there's a greater reward in heaven for the people of God. That there's a better way to live. That there's a way that brings lasting joy. Lasting peace, lasting satisfaction. And Moses looked at Pharaoh and he said, I don't want your money. I don't want your wealth. I don't want your position. Because I'm going a better way, the way to heaven. And that way requires me not to become like you, live like you, worship your gods. You see, for Moses to become the Pharaoh of Egypt, he would have to have people worshiping him because the Pharaohs thought that they were gods as well. And Moses said, no, it's not for me. There's no joy in this. There's no lasting peace and pleasure in such a life. And he refused. Notice it says he refused. He made a choice. He thought it through and then he said, no, I'm going to go a different way. Haman, by contrast, he said, no, I find happiness in all of these external things. This is what I build my life on. Of course, it didn't last. It only lasted from the king's palace to the king's gate, his happiness. And he comes home. Verse 10, Esther chapter 5. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself. Even though he had power, he didn't have the power over life or death. He wasn't a king. He couldn't deal with Mordecai at that moment. Even though he wanted to kill him, hated him. So he comes home. It says, when he came home, and here's the pride of Haman. He sent and called for his friends. Oh, the little spoiled child needs someone to massage his ego. And he calls his wife and he calls all his friends because he wants to be cheered up because he's huffing. He's having a tantrum. Now, this one person won't bow down to me. I'm not happy. I need someone to make me happy. Now, how does the world find happiness? Well, you'll discover in the next verse, verse 11. Here's the pride of man. And Haman told them. So he gathered them all, not to see what he could do for them, not to see if he could help them, not to see had they any problems. No, he gathers them to hear about him so that he can boast to them. And we're told he told them of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children. You see, the Persians believed that the more children you had, particularly the more sons you had, the more prestigious you were. They're very proud to have many, many sons. And Haman clearly had a number of sons. And he wanted everybody to know, I'm somebody. And we're told all the things wherein the king had promoted him. And how he had advanced him above all the other princes and servants of the king. And verse 12, here he even adds this. Yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared, but myself. Oh, this is all about me. How great I am. I'm so rich. I'm so powerful. I'm so connected. I'm so well liked. I have such a wonderful family. Wow. Do you notice the pronouns that keep coming out as you read these two verses? Me, myself. But you notice who's missing in the thoughts of Haman? God's missing, isn't it? This is the pride of man. I always keep telling you the word pride has one letter in the middle of it. What is it? I. That's pride. It's the attempt to kick God off his throne in your life and say, I rule my life. Everything is for my glory, my honor, my efforts. It all belongs to me. And Haman wants everybody to know. He's boasting. And you know, he thinks this is the greatest day of his life. And from a human perspective, it was. Remember, Haman is a foreigner, an ethnic minority in the Persian Empire. And he has been raised up to become the king's favorite of all the other leaders. He has a great family. No doubt his wife, Zeresh, is a very beautiful woman. He has all the money he needs. And he says, to make it even sweeter, if it couldn't get any better, the queen likes me as well. Probably this guy Haman thought the queen fancied him. He probably was so proud that he thought that she couldn't help but be attracted to such a great man like him. And he says, the queen will only let me come. No other man, only me. And instead of keeping that information quiet, he boasts and he boasts. But then in verse 13, he says, yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Isn't that a great example of the emptiness of a life without Jesus Christ? One little thing destroys his whole happiness. Because his life is built around people sucking up to him, people praising him. His life is built around him and his image. And if just one person doesn't like him, wow, he's having a nervous breakdown. But then verse 14 says this, "Then said Zeresh," this is the wife, his wife, "and all his friends unto him," that they could see this guy's having a real meltdown here. He's a little snowflake, Haman. And they said, "Well, here's how we solve it. Don't worry, little boy, we'll take care of you. The tantrum's over. Here's what you do." And of course, they thought this will appeal to his ego. And it really does. They said, "Let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high." Now, 50 cubits is 75 feet. It's about the height of this building here, Lucky Plaza. Now, that's an enormous height to build for a gallows. And they says, "Tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Haman may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the bank." We've got the solution. We've got the magic medicine for you, Haman, to cure your tantrum. The guy that has annoyed you, you go to the king, ask for his life, and then build the 75-foot gallows. Now, why does he build it 75 feet high? Why did they even suggest 75 feet high? Because they knew by building such a gallows and hanging this man on the gallows for a few days, everybody in Persia could see, this is what happens if you cross Haman. This is how great he is. This is how powerful he is. Don't dare disrespect him. So this is feeding the ego, feeding the pride of this guy, Haman. And of course, such a suggestion makes Haman very happy because his mood swings again. Here's the roller coaster. He was up, then he's down, then he starts the boasting, but he says, as he goes, boast, 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 then he says, but this guy, Mordecai, oh, back down again. And then his wife and his friends say, listen, listen. Why don't you ask for a 75-foot gallows? And everybody will see how great you are, how powerful you are. And he's happy again. Oh, that's a great idea. Now, let me just make a simple point about life partners and friends. Be careful who you marry. Be careful who your close friends are. Because they can make you or break you. Because Zeresh, his wife, she thinks she might even be helping Haman, but actually she's preparing him for his own destruction. And these friends who massage his ego and make this suggestion with her, they're also sowing the seeds of Haman's destruction. And he's so stupid he doesn't even see it. What should they have said to him? They should have said to him, listen, Haman, God has been very good to you. Providence has blessed you with all these riches and positions. And far more than you deserve. Far, far more. And privileges that you don't deserve. You need to start cultivating a thankful heart, Haman. You need to stop being so proud, Haman. That's what they should have been telling him. And his wife, in particular, should not have been blowing his ego up more. She should have been deflating it. A faithful friend wounds the proud. Isn't that right? The best wife, the best friend, would have been one who took the word of God and said to Haman, you're fighting against God here. Haman, Pride goes before a fall, Haman. You're in danger. Be careful. Be wise, Haman. If you turn to the book of Psalms, this is what they should have been calling Haman. Psalm chapter 7, Psalm 7. And they should have said to Haman these words. From a king who was a far greater man than Haman ever was. And it says in verse 15 of the wicked, he made a pit and digged it and is fallen into the ditch which he made. That's good advice, isn't it? You reap what you sow. Often the one who digs the trap for others falls into the trap. That's the advice they should have shared with Haman. Because what is going to happen with this 75-foot gallows that he builds? He is going to be the one that will hang from those gallows. The pit that he digged for Mordecai, he's going to fall into it. And his friends, particularly his wife, if she really cared about him, should have said to him, you're behaving like a fool, Haman. You're behaving like a spoiled child. But you see, he married the wrong wife. He cultivated the wrong friendships. And as a consequence, they gave him the wrong advice. And from the wrong advice, he did the wrong thing. And in the end, it'll cost him everything. And that's what will happen. Be very careful who you cultivate as your friends. Now, never had things looked so dark for Esther, for Mordecai, and for the Jewish people. However, by allowing the circumstance to get so dark, God is going to get the greater glory now when he eventually intervenes to deliver. You've got to see God doing this. This is often how he works. He lets things go on to the last minute, till your foot has almost fallen over the edge of the cliff, before he reaches his hand and pulls you out. And you'll discover that in your life. God doesn't always intervene at the beginning. Sometimes not even in the middle of a problem. Sometimes he only intervenes at the last possible second. And that's what he's doing in this story. He's setting up the story for God to get the greater glory in this deliverance. Now, God is not impressed and God is not intimidated by the little Hamans of this world. And neither should you be intimidated. And I'm sure you have people in your life who are like Haman. Maybe you live in the same house as one. Maybe you go to work with a whole bunch of Hamans every day. Little proud peacocks. And they think that they're in control. They think that they can destroy you. They think that they can pull you down. And you have to have the same attitude here as Esther and Mordecai. You have to be willing to let God deal with them. And God is going to handle Haman. It's no problem to God. There's no problem. But he'll do it in his time and in his way. And things may look hopeless right now for you. You may feel absolutely helpless right now. What should you do in such a moment? One last passage, Psalm 32. We're in the Psalms today. Let's go to Psalm 32. Another psalm of King David. He says in verse 6, for this shall everyone that is godly pray unto thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Surely in the floods of great waters they shall not come nigh unto him. And then he says this, thou art my hiding place. Thou shalt preserve me from trouble. Thou shalt compass me about with songs of deliverance. Selah. So David says, things may look dark, things may look dangerous, things may look as if they're out of control, but never forget God is in control. He can preserve you. He knows what he's doing. Now, how will you find your way out? Verse 8, Psalm 32. I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. God says, don't worry. If you just leave it to me, I can handle the little Hamans. They're no problem to God. I can squash them like an insect on my foot. But he says, just be patient. Because I write the last chapter of the history of this world. I write the last chapter of your life. I'm God. That's what he's telling you. Be still. Just wait. Don't panic. Don't be confused. And that is what's going on with Esther and Mordecai here in this story. You just wait next week and you'll see how God begins to turn it around. How God starts to deliver Mordecai, Esther, and the Jewish people. Isn't it great being a child of God? Isn't it great? Isn't it great to know you're on the winning side? You know, if you're running the Olympics and you believe you're the fastest and the best trained, there's still an element of nerves before the gun goes, isn't it? Because you just don't know what might happen on the day. There's no guarantee you'll definitely win. But the Christian can say, I have the guarantee. I'm not at the gun waiting for the race to start and wondering, can I make it to the end? Can I win in the end? Because we already know. He wrote the end of the book, Revelation chapter 22. We win. God wins. So don't give up. Don't be intimidated by these little warts of people with their inflated egos and their proud boasts. They may be big compared to you, but they're not big compared to God. And this story will just let us know there's only one king who reigns over Persia, and it's not Ahasuerus. It's the King of Kings. You know, two or three hundred years after the death of Jesus Christ, there's a famous pastor called John Chrysostom. He was appointed the pastor or the bishop of a church in a place called Constantinople. Today we call it Istanbul. There was an empress on the throne at that day called Eudoxia. And Eudoxia was a very carnal, ungodly woman. John Chrysostom said to her, you're doing the wrong thing. You're living the wrong way. If you don't change, God is going to deal with you. She got very upset with him. She said, do you not know who I am? Do you not know that if you challenge me with your religion, I can have you thrown out, exiled from your position and from this empire? In fact, she says, I can have you put to death. The old preacher looked at her and he said these words. He said, what can I fear? Will it be death? He says, but you know that Christ is my life and that I shall gain with death. Can't harm me. He went on to say, will it be by exile? Kick me out of my home, kick me out of my job, kick me out of my people. He says, remember this, the earth and its fullness belong to the Lord. He says, poverty I do not fear, riches I do not sigh for, and from death I do not shrink. And having said those words, the queen walked away. Because what can you do to a man or a woman who fears nothing but God? The answer is nothing. Nothing. When their happiness is simply tied up to God and God alone and their relationship with Him, it takes a miracle to do that in our lives, doesn't it? In a few moments, we're going to sing a song together. It took a miracle. It is no secret what God can do. You've heard me tell the story of this song before. It's quite an amusing song, the story. Because at the start of the 20th century, a young boy was born into a pastor's home. In fact, the father was a Methodist pastor in Texas, in the United States. And his parents taught that little boy right from wrong. They talked to him about Jesus Christ. They spoke to him about the gospel. They told him he's a sinner. But when that little boy became an adult, he decided, I don't need religion anymore. I don't need this Christianity stuff. I'm going to Hollywood, and I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be rich, and I'm going to be popular. And that young boy went to Hollywood, and he became rich, and he became famous, and he became popular as a singer and as an actor. But one day, after living a terrible life, womanizing, gambling, drinking, wasting his life, he felt so empty. And as he was going past an old tent, there was a sign on a gospel meeting. And he decided to go in and sit down and listen. As he listened to the message that was preached, God began to speak to him. God began to show him, once again, he's a sinner. He's lost. And he needs a Savior. And through that sermon, that man was gloriously converted. He was great friends with many of the other movie stars and actors and song singers in Hollywood. And one of his best friends was a man called John Wayne. Most of you have heard of John Wayne, the big cowboy. John Wayne, he was a great womanizer, great drinker, gambler. John Wayne came to his house for dinner, and John Wayne said to him, I want to hear. What happened to you? You used to be such a drinker. You used to be just like me. How is it that you've changed? And the man looked at John Wayne, and he says these words, it is no secret what God can do. What he's done for me, John Wayne, he can do for you. You know what John Wayne said to him? The big cowboy. John Wayne says, you should write a song about that. John Wayne took his coat, got into his car, went home. And that man called Stuart Hamblin took out his pen, went to his piano, and he composed this famous old hymn, It Is No Secret What God Can Do. What he's done for others, he can do for you. With arms wide open, he'll pardon you. He'll welcome you. It is no secret what God can do. Don't be intimidated by the little Hamans. Just make sure you've got God on your side. Because it is no secret what God can do. And if he doesn't deliver you today, he might do it tomorrow. And if he doesn't do it tomorrow, I promise you he'll do it the day he takes you out of this world. He'll deliver you from this world into a better world forevermore. Let's stand and sing this famous old hymn.